Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, I'm Paula Blair and you're listening to Audiovisual Cultures, the podcast that explores lots of different areas in film, the arts and media. I've got a cheekily timed reissue for you today. The Last of Our Lost episodes is number 34. Fresh out of the screening chat with Dr. Andrew Scheel way back in 2018 about Bohemian Rhapsody, the Freddie Mercury and Queen biopic with a troubled production history. The timing of this re-release is a bit tongue-in-cheek and won't matter at all if you're playing this at any other point in the future, but this falls in the wake of Queen Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee. I'm not trying to be political, although it's no secret that I wouldn't mind having a go at some sort of actual democracy on these islands, but here we are. It seems like as good a week as any to celebrate a British institution, and for me, I choose that to be a bisexual son of Parsi Indian parents whose four-octave-ranged singing voice and flamboyant stage persona made him perhaps the greatest rock performer of all time. But that's just me. Before catching up with 4 years younger Paula and Andrew, a massive thank you to our champion patrons over at patreon.com/AVCultures who enjoy lots of extra goodies in return for their support. I really appreciate shoutouts for AV Cultures Pod on socials as well, especially if they've got a confidence booster in store. I can always use those. For example, episode 112 guest John Badger reached out on Twitter about his guest experience saying, "Holy cow, if I didn't know me, I'd think I was mildly intelligent. Your editing skills are on point. I couldn't be more pleased. Thank you." You're very welcome, John. I do offer a quality service. I may not be able to pay myself or my guests, but quality and fun conversation are guaranteed. If you're interested in being part of the show as a guest or to have your feedback read out, head over to the contact and get involved pages at audiovisualcultures.com. For now, the show must go on, so let's go stone cold crazy and ride the wild wind with this discussion of Bohemian Rhapsody. One, mainly when quoting from the film or things the real Mercury is known to have said and performed. We also discuss the film's imagining of Mercury's sexuality and AIDS diagnosis. And of course, we spent a lot of time on the music and depictions of the performances in the film. Do enjoy.
Crowded Tyneside Cinema, picking up quite a lot of noise, but we'll have a go. Scheel, do you want to say what we're out of? Because I think it's been a thing that for both of us, but probably a wee bit more you than me.
Yes, it's my karaoke band of choice. Yes, we have just been to see Bohemian Rhapsody, which was amazing.
Really good.
And cinematically amazing, as well as having a really powerful story.
Yeah.
It's a story that both of us knew bits of already.
Yeah.
And it's also a story that in the version we've just seen, it is part fiction as well, and that was acknowledged in the end credits, yeah. So it's quite compressed, bits are taken out, they've conflated two or three normal people into one fictional character, that kind of thing. It's par for the course, still a lovely bit of cinema. The woman next to me kept talking to the screen, and I really didn't blame her.
No, it was lovely. It was one of those films that I didn't mind any stuff going on in the audience because they were with the film.
Yeah.
It was one of those sorts of films where it was people who were huge fans and had so much love for the story, the people in it, for Freddie. There was a man a couple of seats over from me was really tapping his legs during the live aid sequence. It just made you want to get up and dance, so I didn't blame him. You know, it was great. The crowd was really with the film the whole way, and it was a packed out screen.
We made the rather silly mistake of going, well, it'll be a 2:30-ish Sunday afternoon screening. There'll be no need to book ahead. There'll be plenty of seats. That was silly. This film's doing really well, clearly. This is a film with a fantastic soundtrack, of course, but also a fantastic sound design. In part, there's that bit with you can see Queen in the studio recording their first album, and they're being really experimental with stereo. And so, of course, in order to show that they're being really experimental with stereo, and they're telling the sound engineer what to do, of course, the same stereo effects have to be replicated in the cinema.
Yeah.
And so there was all of this flipping the sound from the left speaker to the right speaker going on. So
they're
exactly
telling
the same
you,
thing.
Yeah, it's quite reflexive in that way. They're showing what's happened in the production of the film as well as the song. Maybe I knew this and I forgot because that's how my brain works these days. But in the opening credits, I find it a bit shocking when I saw Bryan Singer's name. He's probably the obvious choice, but also he's just a name at the minute because he's one of the many people who's had allegations in the past couple of years.
Right. Yeah.
So I had one of those jerks that you get, but I don't really know the details of his thing.
A good few people have had allegations and turned out to have been completely squeaky clean.
Yeah, well.
Now, kudos for this goes to the guy who played Freddie Mercury.
Rami Malek, I think.
Kudos for this goes to Rami Malek for doing an epic, just inserting himself into Freddie Mercury bit of acting for this. He was in almost every shot. He was physically Freddie from the absolute first moment when we see him. He's just getting ready to go out to listen to a local band in the first scene, all the way up to the very long climactic scene at Live Aid. They made it clear that every band gets 20 minutes at Live Aid. I think that that was a real time version of that, their entire 20 minutes set.
I think it was the actual soundtrack of it, certainly the band.
Yeah, there's even bits where he mixed the words scan a bit differently in the version of Bohemian Rhapsody that he did at Live Aid.
Yeah.
And they did that as well. They had Rami Malek do the same slightly different way of singing some of the lines.
He was miming the whole time. I thought that was Freddie's voice. Or did they do that thing where they mixed them?
I think that by that point we've got an audio where we've been getting Freddie's voice mixed on top of Rami Malek's voice so many times that it was virtually impossible to tell. He was so Freddie. Given there's so much footage of him doing live performances that it's very easy to do Freddie.
Well,
and he's also quite huge and pantomimic, so that also makes it quite easy to do Freddie as well. But to do it consistently and to do it with that much energy all the time,
it
must have been utterly.
And the amount of training, but I don't know, I think it would take a lot of training, because that's the thing about somebody like Freddie Mercury, so truly unique in that sense, where he was this one of a kind and he knew it. I think it would take a huge amount of effort to become Freddie. This is a film I think that had been in development for quite a while. There were rumours that Sacha Baron Cohen might have taken on the role of Freddie Mercury,
right,
and things fell through, so I think it took them a long time to find Freddie.
It's important when you're doing a film like this that your actors who are playing these real people don't bring lots of persona with them. They don't bring lots of real world.
Yeah, you need an unknown really for this.
The actors who they got for Roger Taylor and for John Deacon and for Brian May were all really similar looking to the three
really
people who
like them.
There's fine work in casting, there's fine work in plotting, the audio soundscape of the entire film really well done. And then there's bits where cinematographically the film is just right up in Freddie's head. There's
that
press conference where he's really stressed, and these extreme shallow focus fisheye lenses we used, bit where he's on stage at Live Aid. Some of the shots is the kind of extreme close-up which you can only do by completely computer generating the entire shot. You can only get that much in focus in an extreme close-up.
Yeah, there was
completely
some
CG.
Inventive stuff going on with having it going through the instruments almost.
Yeah.
There's the part where it's going through the tour bus, and there's a bit where at the Live Aid part where it goes underneath the piano.
It went under Freddie's stool.
It goes through the stool. And it runs right up to Brian May's guitar, I think it is. It's almost as if it's scampering across the stage. Even the camera gets involved in the play of it.
And then
all.
In the next couple of shots, then we have the camera become like a drone cam above the crowd.
Uh-huh.
And be really high up looking down on them, and then it would swoop down and then go through the arms of the crowd as they were doing the clap clap thing whatever something they did.
At that time?
It was different from We Will Rock You. It was different from the Doge Doge. It was We Are the Champions.
It might have been that one. That's one of the things. There's so many of the songs, and they had so many albums as well. There's so many of the songs packed into the film. But there was one glaring omission for me, and then I realised they're saving it to the end, and that was Don't Stop Me Now, and they're saving it for the credits.
And of course, they had to also have after that in the credits, The Show Must Go On as well, because that was one of the tracks on their album Innuendo, I think it was called. The last one released while he was still alive, and of course, a song that says The Show Must Go On is a full stop of a song.
Yeah.
Even though there was then another Queen album released later. writer of stuff they recorded in the last few months of his life. They did the AIDS storyline quite intelligently,
yeah.
I think. Just having him realise that he's got it and then having all of these moments of crisis and then him just facing up to it and going, no, screw it, I'm not going to become a poster for this disease. Yeah. I'm going to just make music between now and I go.
It makes it very clear. It shows the news report saying that there is no cure for this and it's happening too fast. In this time in the 80s, to get a handle on it, he knows his time is limited, so he lives for every minute. It's the very poetic thing of he meets who would become the love of his life, Jim Hutton. Jim says to him, come and find me when you like yourself. When Freddie wises up and realises who he really is and becomes that person, then he has a happy few years and they have a loving relationship. And it's very compact, it's very condensed, but they show how strong that is.
I have to say, this was a bit of a brave pausing decision to have the film end as they're walking off stage at the Live Aid concert in 1985.
Yeah.
When he lived for another
6 more years.
6 and a bit years.
Yeah.
And that 6 years contained at least 2 more studio albums.
Yeah.
And they did stop touring. That was the thing. They stopped touring right at the point when I just about became old enough to go and see them in concert.
I've always loved Queen's music, but I think by the time I was really aware of them and who they were, Freddie Mercury was dead. I didn't have beginning of albums. My parents were huge into the Beach Boys, so that gives you an idea of the musical background that I have.
I'm actually not clear where the huge presence of Queen in my childhood came from, but maybe it was my older brother, maybe it was my dad. It was just everywhere.
Yeah.
There was a certain point when suddenly Queen was just everywhere.
Yeah.
I can't place it. I found myself going, okay, so we know about this Queen, which is producing albums now. We know about the 1980s Queen. I want to know about more Queen. Then I find out about the 1970s Queen. Then the kind of early 1980s Queen that was a bit poppy and a bit weird. There's very few hits from that album they did in the early 1980s. Then the Queen of Flash Gordon. And Highlander, the Queen who does movie soundtracks. But there's so many different Queens. And then the Queen of Night at the Opera and Day at the Races.
Opera.
And I love the jokes about I'm in love with my car.
Yeah.
It's quite a good song, actually. It's got that operatic feel to it. There was all this conflict, masses of conflict to do with business as well, and whether you can have a single which is over 6 minutes long, which was Bohemian Rhapsody. How are they going to solve that problem? And having Mike Myers as the executive at EMI, whose name escaped me.
Accent was brilliant.
Yes.
Remember seeing his name in the credits? But okay, I'll have to look out for him. And of course, he's so well disguised.
Yeah.
Because guys wear a lot of makeup, and he's very familiar for some reason. But it didn't twig with me for quite a while. Yeah. I really liked that.
This film had 2 Wayne's World references in it, didn't
it? Absolutely.
It had him doing this basically cameo as the person who gets to decide whether Queen's songs get released.
You could not have the Wayne's World references. Yeah. But
continue. Someone saying, we want songs that kids are going to be headbanging in their cars.
Wayne's World.
And a specific statement that Bohemian Rhapsody is not going to be the song that kids will be headbanging
That song. And then Don't Stop Me Now would become the song that you hit zombies to with sugar cues.
In Shaun of the Dead?
In Shaun of the Dead.
So many references. Fine work. We needed to see a film like that, I think.
Absolutely. The film, the way it flowed, felt like a rock opera almost as well. But also the way that Freddie's relationships, whether it's with his family, whether it's with Mary.
Yeah.
It's played really beautifully by Lucy Boyton, I think it is.
In that relationship, Freddie is a douche. I know that he had a long-term life partner who was a woman. So as far as I was aware, Freddie was bisexual. And yet the version we've got just there was that he married somebody and then they didn't get divorced, but he wants her to be his beard for a bit and then moves on to a situation where they're just good friends and he's having male partners. He seems to have accepted that he's completely gay. But as far as I was aware, he was actually bisexual and been knowingly bisexual for his entire adult life, rather than having this, I think I'm straight, now I think I'm gay. And the mention of bisexuality came and went, almost like it's not a thing.
Yeah.
Like it's someone who can't really decide.
And it comes from him, you know, he says, Mary, I think I'm bisexual.
And she dismisses that.
She just says, Freddie, I've known for a while that you're gay. Yeah, she dismisses that, and it's never really picked up. And he seems to only ever have male lovers after that.
Yeah.
You see, I think the relationship with this guy, Paul, who was his minder, his manager,
his everyday,
his right-hand guy for years, which I knew nothing about before, was this guy from Belfast, actually. Did you know if any of that's true?
No, I didn't know about that at all.
Well, we'll need to look into that. I didn't know anything about this. So anyway, the character of Paul, at least, he's quite an emotionally manipulative. I mean, it's a very controlling relationship. And it's really what we would call an abusive relationship that they get into, which Paul almost grooms him and takes him away from Queen. It arranges things because this CBS offer to do solo work, it seems like he thinks on his feet. I'm not sure if I'm picking that up right, but it seems like he gets wind of this offer. He gives it to the manager. Is it John Reid?
Yes.
Played by Aidan Gillen. And says it should come from you. So it's all very underhand and manipulative. And then John proposes it to Freddie, and Freddie flips out, fires him, and this guy Paul claims, I warned him not to do it.
Yeah.
But obviously it's his idea. Because it could go either way, because if he loves it, then yes, it's his idea. But if he turns out not to love it, he gets really hurt that they're trying to break him away from the band. And so fires John, but then ends up later on doing it because this guy Paul has obviously worked on him for a while. He's trying to siphon him away from all his true friends. The film implies, at least, that he brings him into this world of, what would you call it? It's queer culture turbo. But it's a whole masochistic side of gay culture.
In Munich.
Yeah.
I was rather aware that bit happened, that there was this thing when Freddie just immersed himself into the gay subculture of Germany. And it was all very leather. It was the particularly gay subculture that Freddie, of course, had affiliated himself with in some regards in some of the albums, just in the way that he dressed.
Yeah, just it's performative,
But this is kind of arseless chaps.
Yeah.
Whips, right?
And masks and bondage gear.
And going into this as somebody who's a bit naive.
And
so apparently that he got into the gay subculture of Munich specifically in the early 80s. Apparently that was all real. But apparently he did that when the band were actually recording an album in Germany. It wasn't a matter of a thing that happened when he went off and did the solo album.
Yeah.
So I think that was two different events rolled together in the film. And the solo albums, some of the music's okay. Some of it's quite good. And it got re-released as a kind of greatest solo hits of Freddie Mercury after he died as well. I did have a cassette. I had a cassette tape with that on somewhere. The stereo. Yeah, but clearly what the film says is this isn't you. And so the film very clearly goes, this environment in which you get AIDS isn't you. If you just stuck to operatic tea drinking, dressing up fun that you were into in London and that was okay in London, then you wouldn't have got AIDS. So there is the kind of an association of AIDS with a hedonistic gay subculture.
Yeah.
A slightly brutal gay subculture there, which may be perpetuating some long-standing stereotypes about homosexuality from the viewpoint of straight people. And also, this is looking back and it's going, weren't these people silly for having unprotected sex? But this was a new disease. The sense was, you can get sexually transmitted infections from having same-sex sex. It's not necessary to have heterosexual sex in order to get STIs. But the idea was that you could get around it by just not having penetrative sex. Whereas AIDS is more infectious, and because it's much more lethal than diseases like gonorrhea.
With needle sharing as well, there's no signs of heroin use or anything like that. But there's the debris of cocaine use, so there are hints of heavy drug use going on.
The film does not pull punches about this.
No, absolutely not.
When you get rich like that, it's tempting to do some drugs.
That's what you do. I think it implies that he's been led into this. It's almost like he's been groomed by this guy Paul, and this guy Paul has wanted all these things. Freddie, in the film, basically becomes his bitch, you know. He's the puppet master, and then Freddie gets wise when Mary comes.
Almost certainly, the reality was more complicated.
I would say so, obviously.
As it was in most
of
other elements of the film.
It must have been. But it does the whole thing of Paul then, when Freddie gets wise to him very quickly one night in rainy Germany, when Mary comes for 5 minutes from England, fires him on the spot, gets rid of him, says, I never want to see you again. There's all these analogies of things. You know, he says, that's how you know you've gone rotten, is when all the fruit flies come. But then Paul cashes in on that. and it's the kiss and tell type thing. You know, he gets loads of money for doing all the media about Freddie and bad mouthing him and that sort of thing, but you don't know to what extent anything is true. It's a fictionalization, so maybe it's a moment of feeling sorry for Freddie that this awful thing's happened. It's hard to know what the truth is.
And I suppose we could say this is a film which was trying to make Freddie seem squeaky clean.
Yeah, very innocent.
But it did at least say he was a dick to the band when it came to doing those two solo albums.
Yeah.
It hasn't very overtly been a dick and then apologising for it afterwards. It hasn't very clearly been quite controlling with Mary after they've clearly split up.
Yeah.
Keeps seeming to think that she needs
to be. She belongs to him.
Yeah.
He gets annoyed when she gets pregnant and moves on and is happy.
And we also have to point out that the way the film seems to make it the ideal thing that this band needs to get back together after Freddie has this crisis in Germany with his solo albums and Paul and realising that he's in that crappy relationship and also realising he's sick. The way the film makes us really want to get, or make me, makes the implied viewer, really want this band to get back together is that these four people are a comedy quartet.
Yeah.
Whenever they're recording stuff together, they seem to really play off each other in such a way that whenever there's conflict, one of them just needs to make a joke and then everything's fine again. So there's a moment when there's conflict over Another One Bites the Dust. It's just about getting anyone to do any work.
Mm-hmm.
And they're beginning to actually have a physical fight. And then I think it happens off screen. It's just John Deacon just playing
just
the bass line of Another One Bites the Dust.
And they go, oh, this is really great actually. Oh, wait, we make great musicals. Why do we not trust each other?
So there's all these moments of, oh, is it all going to go wrong? And then it just kind of crumples back together.
Yeah.
Because they're all genuinely good humoured and being part of Queen is a good thing to do. And then, of course, when they get back together shortly before Live Aid, and almost certainly that didn't happen because they've actually got together somewhere.
Oh, you've been to rehearse for more than a week.
Live Aid.
For performance that good, you need to rehearse for more than a week.
And suddenly it's all working again and they're all making jokes again. And so it's the comedy of the film. And the comedy in dramas like this is really essential to have those moments here and there of and diffuse.
Yeah, there's a lot of it. It works really well and it's very tightly timed and everything. And the crowd's really with it because it was great seeing it with a packed cinema full of people who were clearly fans back in the day and now.
I just want to share one moment of what the woman next to me said during this film. In the bit when they had recorded A Night at the Opera, the entire album at the farmhouse, and they were trying to persuade the executive of EMI, played by
Mike Myers,
to release Bohemian Rhapsody as a single. Oh no, hang on, it wasn't that one, it was beforehand, when they were saying, let's do this opera album, it's going to be New
trying
Queen.
To convince him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Freddie plays him a bit of opera, and he says, it's going to be musical theatre, it's going to be lavish, it's going to be fantastic. And he goes, no one listens to opera, no one likes opera. And the woman next to me went, liar.
I think I heard.
I found myself thinking, not quite. I mean, perhaps mistaken might be the best word, but also I thought, you're talking to the screen. Interacting with the screen as if there's no one else here.
But
and as if it's
on
real.
Her own.
As if it's absolutely real. Yeah.
But you do. It was real in the moment. It was really immersive. It is the sort of film where if we watched it at home, we'd be pausing and going, you know, getting really excited and saying things and going, did you notice that? So I don't blame her at all. She's getting really into it.
And we're going to have to be out of this building in about 3 minutes before they take it apart.
Well, I think that we should do another proper recording as well a bit later when we've got time to look some stuff up, because I think we're going to need to get some details that we aren't able to do at the moment.
One question then before we go.
Mm-hmm.
Did you cry?
I welled up a fair few times, I have to say.
Yeah, me too.
Really did. I nearly went a few times.
That's the kind of film where I'd want to film the audience. I want to see what people are saying, I want to see how rapt they are, I want to see where they laugh, and I want to see whether and where they cry.
Oh, and we have to mention, before I forget, before even the opening credits, the 20th Century Fox.
Oh, yes.
And
they did a special version of the 20th Century Fox fanfare
with
CinemaScope Extension, which was a rock version done with lead guitar rather than trumpets.
Yeah, I'd like to know who played that, because it wouldn't surprise me if Brian May did it.
I think we have to go and consult the internet.
I think this is why we need to go and be able to look stuff up. So we'll speak to you anon.
From Wikipedia about a few things I didn't know about Freddie Mercury, including that he was a British citizen from birth. Probably something to do with the fact that his father worked at the British Colonial Office in Zanzibar. Also that he was He was a member of several other bands before he introduced himself to Smiles. That's one of those ways in which they've simplified.
Mm-hmm.
Briefly called himself Larry Lurex.
I just realised that I completely missed the Kenny Everett bit.
What do you mean you missed it?
As in, I didn't realise that that was Kenny Everett.
Everett.
I am
really?
So slow. Why are you even talking to me on your podcast,
Dr.
Blair?
I can't believe you didn't realise it was Kenny Everett.
This is familiar. I think that this is supposed to be somebody who I know. Can't work out who it is, but yeah, it's Kenny Everett. Yeah. And that apparently that was a big part of Bohemian Rhapsody getting airplay, was that they were already mates.
Mm.
Because they were quite flamboyant, and that it was Everett who first put that song on a turntable on a national radio station on Capital London. Even though Capital Radio itself hadn't actually accepted the song, Everett just pretended to accidentally play it.
He did a John Peel.
On one occasion, Everett played the song 36 times on one day. I thought that it was something to do with it being a B-side to something else. That's the way that you tend to get something to get airplay that doesn't fit with the formula. I could quite possibly spend the rest of the day just reading stuff about Freddie Mercury. So, the film we've just seen.
We've been reading a bit more and getting some clarification. So, it's interesting, actually, the production context. It does seem to have been quite a dogged, very long process, and the plot thickens with the director, because we had both noticed that Dexter Fletcher was in the executive producer credits.
There's often quite a weighty list of executive producers for films.
Yeah.
And this can mean quite a few things. But in Dexter Fletcher's case, it turns out that he got an executive producer credit because he directed something like the last quarter of principal photography, and of course sat in on editing as well, did like all that post-production director stuff as well, after Bryan Singer had what seems to have been a family crisis.
Yeah, because I think I vaguely remember reading about things like that, but it was just one of those fleeting things that you read and didn't really pay much attention to at the time.
And we're always so accustomed to hearing production news about films that are not going to be coming out for several years, that we don't want to get our hopes up, so we set this stuff aside and just keep doing it, and then suddenly there's a film being released. So it seems that this film has been in production in one form or another, well, that has been being made, because there's pre-production business, in one form or another since 2010, and so we're quite lucky to have finally got a film out of the big team of people who were involved in this, which included Jim Beach, who appears in the film, or at least who is played in the film very well by Tom Hollander. Tom Hollander doesn't do much actual using his face to act, but I think then it's just the person who you cast as people who aren't very expressive and plays those people very well.
He's become a real stalwart, I think, of British film. He's been in so many indies and big blockbusters that have been filmed here as well, I think, in bit parts. I think I first remember him, wasn't he the real Weasley one in Pirates of the Caribbean?
In the second and third films.
Was it the second ones? That's my first real memory of him in film.
Yeah.
But yes, he's good at playing his characters. It was nice actually to see him as one of the backbone characters in Bohemian Rhapsody. So it was nice to see him as a good guy.
I'm just reading here about a research project undertaken in 2016 to understand the appeal behind Freddie Mercury's voice, which identified that he definitely had a vocal range of just over 3 octaves, which is quite some
very unusual
range. And that he has a faster vibrato than other singers. There we go, we're having a scientific explanation of why this guy's voice
really
was quite captivating. And, okay, part of the sound design, we're in a situation of being really unable to tell with this. Part of the sound design seems to have been placing a layer of audio from all the recordings of Freddie Mercury's voice on top of what we're getting from Rami Malek's voice. And then there's certain points where it's Rami Malek singing, and then certain points where it gets a slightly different quality. But, of course, he's trying to sound as much like Freddie Mercury as possible. So there's a real uncertainty about whose voice we're actually getting at any one point. Of course, Dr. Blair and I have decided to compare the size of our Queen collections.
Mine's quite fragmented though, because I don't have full albums. It's just a few songs from lots of different albums I've got. It was from someone else's digital collection.
Sweet Lady, one of the lesser known songs from Night at the Opera. This is the one with the line that's ridiculed in the film, where one of them says, "What's this? You call me sweet like I'm some kind of cheese? What does that even mean?" Some of the lyrics to some their lesser known songs are weird, but it's not like the lyrics to their more known songs aren't weird. We've just got used to these very weird things that you say in a big operatic voice when singing these songs. And you do really sing these songs, particularly when you do them as karaoke.
Yeah, they're belters. Yeah. I think it's safe to say you could call them.
Yeah.
There's probably quite a lot of things to get through. I think to try and give things a bit of order would be to think about the film as biopic. Genre feels like like the wrong term. Subgenre feels like it doesn't do it enough justice, but the biopic as a mode of storytelling in film is something I find really fascinating. The overwhelming narrative in biopics generally tends to be the great man history. So it's about this one central character who's the hero or anti-hero of the thing. I think what I really liked about this is that it's not titled Freddy, it's not titled Mercury, it's titled Bohemian Rhapsody. Yeah. And that's very much Freddie Mercury's song, but it does mean it is more about the band, and they are such a huge feature, and so much is made of the band in the film, especially them all referring to each other as family. They found their people, they found their tribe.
That's part of the arc of the film, when someone refers to Queen as Freddie's family, and Freddie goes, they're not my family. In the early stage, he says, no, these people aren't my family. And then after he goes through his crisis, and he goes back and he arranges this reunion with them, then he says, you're my family.
Well, it calls back to the very first meeting they have with the people from EMI. Freddie says, we're the misfits, we don't fit. And the other members of the band talk about it as being a family, because none of us fit, and the people that we are doing this for don't fit. We're a different kind of family. So it calls back to that. So Freddie himself didn't say that, but he's part of that discussion where are saying that as a band.
The film's about Queen becoming as queenie as they could possibly be after first trying lots of different ways of doing it and getting it right at some points and not getting it right in other points. And I suppose that does generally fit with the story of what actually happened. And I do get the sense that we've got lots of moments when we're getting a fictionalized account which might be trying to make everyone appear to be better people than they actually were. And they're definitely, we get these fictionalized accounts which is making everyone appear to be a lot more poetic in the way that they speak than the people who actually were in real life. Even Freddie Mercury, that monologue about fruit flies, wow. Particularly as it's done between two people who aren't looking at each other and definitely can't hear each other.
An extremely heavy rain. I mean, torrential downpours of rain. Teeming rain. Looking away from each other and talking quite quietly and intimately away from the other person. And they must be meters apart. Also, Freddie's clearly not well.
Yeah, that too, yeah. It also seems to be something of a rule now that you start films in media res for a minute or so and then you go back and start at the beginning. That's just how you do it. Well, I suppose it's not even in media res because that means in the middle, starting in the middle. We're talking starting them right near the end.
Yeah, well, it's like the coda, isn't it?
Yeah.
In music, it's establishing the theme and establishing the end point and then going back, and then you get extra at the end.
Our first few moments are, this is Freddie Mercury waking up on the morning of the Live Aid concert. He coughs a couple of times and then that's it. And then suddenly he's at the stadium and he's getting ready to go on stage, and we're only seeing him from behind waiting. And then just as he's about to go on stage, then we're flicked back to him working as a baggage handler at Heathrow in 1970. And so the whole film's going to be about getting back up to this moment. And so right from the beginning, it's made clear that, yeah, you all know that this is going to be a story about someone getting ill, and we'll show that we know that you know, and that we're going to get there. But first, let's go and do a story about people making music. The most fun bits were when the band are playing and trying to come up with something that's catchy. When they sell their van and pay for a couple of days in a recording studio and they're just making stuff up as they go along. And they're recording the album that's called Queen. Might even be Queen 2, actually. The one that's got Seven Seas of Rye on it, because that's Seven Seas of Rye is their first hit. And it's one that most people haven't even heard of. And it's very piano, not much guitar in it. That was really enjoyable, showing people experimenting and showing how big they were on stereo, such that they would actually start to wear the tapes out that they were recording on, because they'd been recorded over so many times. And then apparently they would know that this is the point where they had to stop re-recording and re-recording layers of sound on these tapes, because if you held it up, you could see through it. And I just love this idea that the recording medium suffers from having so much put onto it that at some point it might just start to disintegrate.
Wow.
Whereas the way we record now, the recording medium, we don't think of it as something that has material
substance. No, it feels quite virtual, doesn't it?
Yeah. This band, from the very earliest point when they were recording, being really into using stereo, which was a new technology in your average person's home music system. Because stereo had been around in cinema since the shift to widescreen. Stereo had been normal since then. Four-track stereo sound had been normal since then. being the band who basically pioneered the music video, while ironically putting out a song which laments the death of radio because of the rise of the music video. Define irony, Radio Gaga, and being a band that was huge on getting audiences to be part of their gigs. They hit those three notes, stereo, music video, and audience being part of their gigs. And they didn't even do the music video bit with any sort of, hey, let's invent the music video, having that account of an invention story. They just had it so that one of those magical realist moments occurred where the couple of images from the Bohemian Rhapsody video just appeared in the background of one of the scenes, and that was it. You know, over, we've acknowledged that they invented the music video, on we go. They ticked a lot of boxes.
We were talking earlier when we weren't recording about the audience participation, because I was saying that it hadn't really twigged with me before how much of their work was involving the audience. I remember being maybe 14 or so and being just totally captivated by We Will Rock You, and it's such a simple motif, the thump thump clap, you know.
Thump thump clap rest. That rest is really important.
Well, it's the 4-4, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4.
That clap is a slappy sound.
But yeah, it just hadn't dawned on me. But then maybe that's because I was too young for Queen to fully appreciate Queen. By the time I was aware of them, you know, I was hearing Queen songs on the radio. Their songs were on in films, on compilation albums I was getting. And I would see the occasional video if I was watching MTV, VH1 or one of the music channels when I was a teenager. So the participation bit just hadn't really clicked with me until really seeing the film today. And of course, We Were Rocky, it's the main one, and they make the narrative around that really fascinating. It's nice to see that story of the band really loving and interacting with their audience so much, because so many biopics and even fiction films about musicians and bands, it's so much about them and loving the adoration but not really thinking about their fans, not really having much of a relationship with them. But this was so different, and even as an audience member seeing the film, you felt like part of it, and there was so much participation actually in the audience, you know, people clapping and stamping their feet and speaking to the screen, and you know, and it was a code violation that I think is actually acceptable in a film like that, when you're engaging directly with the film and the audience is there with it and each other.
There's legendary myths that go around about the different versions that Freddie would do of the people going, saying, you know, we went to this concert where he did it for 10 minutes.
Wow.
I went to this concert where he did it so that there was 25 notes that we had to remember in the day that we're doing back. Wow, that's a lot of tours. I'm looking at a discography. There was also this ongoing thing of, what would he say at the end? He would, of course, at some point go, now the going is over, but he'd have to do it in some way. So often he'd simply say, wow, you're good. And he would often say, you fuckers are good. And then apparently, like, once or twice, he just went, fuck you. As if to go, I can't outdo you. Or I'll do your song now. And apparently, you know, he'd done that well before Live Aid. It was something he had to do when they did Live Aid. I've got a DVD somewhere of Queen doing a concert in Montreal in the late 70s. He starts off fully clothed, and by the last song, he's just wearing these tiny shorts. He's got so hot over the course of the evening, he's just shedding layer after layer.
He's so dynamic. He's moving all the time. He's so kinetic.
This is the fidgetiest person. Maybe that's why I felt some degree of affinity with him.
Yeah, maybe.
And he's still alive, is because he would not stay still. Loads of kids are really fidgety anyway, but I think even relative to other kids, that was really fidgety.
But you see that in someone who's become this superstar and has managed to make something graceful and beautiful and engaging out of those movements.
There was a point, I think it was with the Miracle album in 1989, where one of those songs that they did, and also just while I'm on this page, look at the cover for the album.
Oh yeah, I remember
creepy?
That one, yeah.
It's so creepy that the heads are stuck together so that between them they have 1, 2, 3, they have 5 eyes. So it's not clear whose eye is whose. Are we seeing 2 of Freddie Mercury's eyes or just 1 and 2 of Roger Taylor's eyes? Anyway, one of the songs is The Miracle. The video for that, they didn't use the band, they used these 4 kids. I think the band appear for about the last 10 seconds of the song. So these 4 kids, they do the entire song as Queen, and each one of these kids who's 11 has learned how to do the person they're impersonating. So, of course, the one who's learned how to do Roger Taylor, who's learned how to do John Deacon, has just learned how to stand very still, completely unexpressive. The one who's learned how to do Roger Taylor has learned to do that spin that he does with the drumsticks. And, of course, the one who's learned how to do Freddie Mercury has learned to prance fantastically across the stage, back and forth. And apparently the band said, when they finished watching all the filming happening, because the band were there when the music video was being filmed, they said, can they do an entire tour for it? It's four little kids doing Queen. Yeah, there's so many of these songs I have not heard for such a long time. They did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, if you count the soundtrack to Flash Gordon.
Mm.
And, of course, A Kind of Magic, which is essentially the soundtrack to Highlander as well. So 15 albums, including the Made in Heaven album, the one they recorded in the last few months of Freddie Mercury's death. That's well over 100 songs.
Mm.
Could we name more than 20 off the top of our heads? That's one of the things, I suppose, about this was that it said, hey, you know these 15 Queen songs that you know? You're going to hear them now. There was the bit when he learns he's got AIDS. They play a little bit of Who Wants to Live Forever without making any mention at all of them having recorded A Kind of Magic. Because that seems to have been what they were recording when they did the Live Aid concert, in reality.
Yeah.
We must not get the set of fictional figures mixed up with reality, of course. Easy to see that as a documentary.
To expand on stuff we were talking about earlier as well, just the characterization of everybody, like a lot of people's characters were pretty fleshed out, but also, you know, it's brilliant to have more representation of Northern Irish / older people on screen, but it would just be lovely if we get to the point where they're not all psychopaths and manipulators. Because there's such a minority of people there that are like that. But you were saying it seems like people like him, the characters like him, are amalgamations of lots of people.
I'm looking various people up, and yes, it seems that a lot of the people who are real-life people are linked in the cast list of Bohemian Rhapsody, but there's several of them who aren't, and that includes, cast list, includes Paul Printer, the personal manager. Wow. Freddie Mercury only made it public in November 1991 that he had AIDS. But it was an open secret by that point. I'm trying to figure out who the character of Paul Prenter is supposed to represent in real life, because they produced a piece of TV footage as if that was a reenactment of a piece of actual TV footage with somebody real. And we both were vaguely aware of this, but as for who it actually was, not clear.
It could just be representative of that kind of thing happening in celebrity culture. The tell-all for lots of money story.
Wow. That 1974 press conference where Freddie was quite snippy with members of the press actually happened.
They really pressed the issue with that press conference. There was a journalist who was really trying to press him about his sexuality. And of course, it's a much bigger deal then than now. But also, it feels like it could be very much speaking to today, because we're still not at a point where it doesn't matter and people are still forced to come out.
That moment where Brian May played by
the Gwilym name was Lee. Strange. Gwilym?
Gwilym.
Gwilym. He's lovely looking. Gwilym Lee. Is he Welsh?
He's English, but that's...
It's quite a Welsh looking name, isn't it? Gwilym. The Tourist, a song for Jenny Jamestown, Midsummer Murders.
That bit where he, playing Brian May, said, anybody want to talk about the music? Anybody want to talk about the album? And he said it about three times. You know, I'd like to listen to the actual recording of that.
Yeah, that would be fascinating.
Because that's screenwriters now going, wouldn't it be great if people just cared less about what we do with each
private.
Other in bed?
You know, and also the humour coming through as well, because people are pressing Freddie about him seeming like he's been ill, and Brian May saying, well, I had a cold last week, if anybody's interested. And Freddie saying, there are four members of this band, I'm not the leader of the band, there are four of us here and you're only asking me questions, why aren't you asking anybody else questions? It was quite a compact way of getting across quite a lot of points, you know, and maybe quite scathing towards the press, but also I think it's probably reflective of what has happened since then, because it feels like it's gone much worse. You've got home magazines, you go and do a shop, you know, you go and get your messages and you just see these things like Chat or women's magazines and stuff, and it's just these snapped private moments of people having a holiday and they're wearing a bikini on a beach, or people snapped in private moments on a night out. They're just trying to be human beings and paparazzi aren't leaving them alone.
And they often claim to have interviews with these people and they quote from the interviews on the front page, and it's lots of people divulging really personal things about themselves and their relationships with other people.
people. We do really, really care now, collectively as a culture, about the private lives of other people.
Yeah.
So yeah, this film was quite a statement about asking this quite brutal question of, why do we care so much? Why do we call these people by their first names? As if they're our neighbours.
I think even the band members, I think it might have been Freddie himself, who says, you know, we belong to them.
Mm.
We belong to the people. But it's that side of them belongs to the people. Although it represents the hedonistic side and the performance of the hedonism, because it does feel like a performance. It feels like, you know, that it shows you the lavish party that he puts on when he has the new big house. But also the really intimate things, like the amount of cats that he has. They each have their own bowl. They have their own room in this massive house. There's not a huge amount of time spent on any of that, but there's enough shot reverse shots between him and the cats.
Yeah.
You know, you get loads of cute cat shots in the film because it's showing you that they're also his family.
Yeah.
All these cats. That's Freddy.
There were a few moments when they were, cats were looking straight at the camera and I thought, that cat's got like lots of crust in the corner of its eye. I wanted to just decrust the cat's eye.
You see that side of him. Yes, he had that side of his life. He had the performing side of his life, the going to the masochistic gay clubs in Germany side of his life.
Hmm.
But he had this domestic life that was loving, and yes, it was very lavish, but it was loving and it was private and full of affection.
There's one of the music videos where it takes the form of this huge orgy's not quite the right word, but orgiastic party,
mm-hmm.
where everyone's wearing masks and huge flamboyant gear, and it seemed that that's the kind of stuff he wanted to have. He didn't want to do debauchery. He just wanted to do flamboyant
enjoyment. Things being exciting and people wearing outfits, uniforms. Many of us would maybe have a phase at some point of our lives where we will try something because we just want to be different, or we want to see, am I that kind of person? So you try something, you push your limits. And then maybe after a while you go, do you know what? This isn't for me. I'm not being true to myself. And so you come back out of it again. And it seems like that may have been his thing. Certainly in the film version of Freddy, that was what happened. And it seems like he was groomed into that by this character, Paul, but seems to have been manufactured out of several real people. So it shows you how easily led somebody can be, and then the pressures of what you're in, and you've got somebody constantly harping on at you, and if you're bickering with your bandmates all the time anyway, then it's a perfect storm of things, isn't it? So somebody who's manipulative enough can just quietly chip away and convince you you're something you're not. And it's interesting because Freddie, his younger self, is much more assertive. You and Paul first tries it on with him when he's working. You know, he disrupts him working.
Yes.
Freddie's at the piano, he's singing, he's writing music. Paul disrupts him and insists, I know you, Freddie Mercury. And Freddie's saying, you don't know me at all. This is all you see of me, is this side of things.
And then that power relationship is switched by the film's low point. The film did a great job of saying, you know, there's this sound that you're used to? Well, that's where this sound comes from. And in some places, this is how creativity... I like seeing creativity represented in films, because sometimes it's creativity where someone's just a total genius and they just go, hey, I've just completely thought of this thing. That genius thing, it mystifies creativity. Mm. This, in some places, went to the other end of the spectrum where that Galileo, that bit in Bohemian Rhapsody, the first time we hear it, is presented as sound bridge over a cock about to crow.
Yes,
so the cock
really
starts
funny.
To crow, and then it goes, the cock seems to be going Galileo, and it's at this farm. So what it implies is that they got these ideas from hearing the crowing of cocks while they were working at the farm, and thought, okay, let's use that sound. So there's all this, people when they're creative, all they do is they just listen to their surroundings. They just watch their surroundings and they write down what goes on. So it's that account of creativity that we get a lot in Shakespeare in Love, where he goes, oh, that thing you just said, I think I'll remember that. You just said a plague on both your houses.
The play must go on. that sort of thing, It's also a really comic, it's a nice light comedy sound bridge as well, you know, because everybody really laughed at that too, because it takes you off guard, you know, because you're expecting the crow to start, and then you hear Roger going, Galileo, higher, make it higher.
And one thing we must acknowledge is that in quite a few Queen songs, even late in their career, Brian May does lyrics and Roger Taylor does lyrics.
They're
they're not the lead singers, but they are singers. One great example is Who Wants to Live Forever.
Mm-hmm.
Half the lyrics in Who Wants to Live Forever are Brian May rather than Freddie Mercury, and gives it that slightly ethereal sound at some point.
there's quite a squealy voice that goes on in a lot of Queen songs, mm-hmm. and that's Roger Taylor's yeah. voice. It's got a quality to it, which is not quite as rangy as Freddie Mercury's, but it's still a Queen mm-hmm. sound. But then the film did also go, you know, sometimes these songs just come out of Freddie's mm-hmm. sternum. The bit where he comes up with the first couple of lines of Bohemian Rhapsody, it's him just sitting on a piano mm-hmm. and he goes bang, 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 bangs it out. And it comes out of him like he's puking. Like it's just this involuntary thing that has mm-hmm. to happen. And then when he's finished it, he's shaking and mm-hmm. he can't breathe properly. So that's the kind of midway point. It's not him getting the sounds from his surroundings, and it's not him having a I'm completely in control moment. It's mm. like that kind of halfway between, which I think is probably more accurate mm. than either of these extremes. I'm trying to find out more about the accuracy of the Munich episode,
but it's a very private thing, you know, yeah. and it feels more like an imagining mm. of that period of his life, and then you don't know how much of that has been imposed. I think you were saying earlier, it feels like the stereotypical, maybe heteronormative view of what that culture could be. It's hard to know, really. And then we don't know exactly what parts Bryan Singer was involved with. We don't know what stamp Dexter Fletcher might have, and that would be very different from Bryan Singer.
This is one of those films where to have been there during the production process mm. would make for a fascinating account mm-hmm. of how films function.
But Dexter Fletcher, having done Sunshine on Lace, mm-hmm. you know, he's directed big musical things before, so he yeah. would have had that energy, especially because that's based on the Proclaimers songs. But it's a bit like Mamma Mia in that it's the characters that are singing the songs, so it's yeah. you know, it's not about the band, it's about characters, and then they burst into these songs, you know, yeah. they're applied to a story. So those big group things, the crowd getting involved, I imagine that could be him. But then Bryan Singer has dealt with massive scale stuff and lots of CGI heavy stuff as well, doing the superhero yeah. films.
I think it was important to get in somebody who wasn't just going to point cameras at actors
yeah.
for this film, because being able to create these virtual cameras that can go anywhere, being able to create these subjective shots where something happens in the background which is clearly just happening in somebody's head, being willing to do that mm. I think is quite important to give this the drama which it deserves. So I think, you know, a surprising choice, but nonetheless a good choice. I would absolutely just love to know which bits of this were Fletcher bits and which bit
yeah,
were Singer bits.
Yeah, it would be really wonderful to know, wouldn't it? Maybe it's in archives.
The whole PhD,
how to,
right?
Yeah, how to access yeah. something. Yeah, because, I mean, even just that idea of, well, this director has completed most of the film but has now gone AWOL, so what do we do? And they have to get somebody else in. Then you're a director and you're a really good director in your own right, but it's not your film. You're a director for hire now yeah. who has to finish it and try and have some sort of continuity with what's already been done. I mean, that must be yeah. really difficult.
We hear a lot about this these days, about people getting brought in partway through a project yeah. to take over directing from somebody else, because that happened with Solo, didn't it?
Of course, yeah, with Ron yeah. Hard.
Put yourself in Dexter Fletcher's shoes. Mm. This film's finally getting made
yeah.
after 7 years. It's a film about Queen. It's uh-huh. mostly done. So about two-thirds, yeah. four-fifths done. Somebody needs to bring it on home,
yeah.
right? You would quite happily both direct it in the style of somebody mm. else and just take an executive producer credit, wouldn't you? Just to get the film made.
Oh, absolutely.
You hear about what's happening with the Terry Gilliam version of Don Quixote finally being made.
Yeah, that's been a really long yeah, time, hasn't it?
And it seems that it has finally been made, but then there's a legal battle happening over whether mm. it can be released. And I think at this point, this film's been waiting in the pipeline for so long. Whoever you are who's standing in the way of getting mm. this thing released, do a deal for the sake of the film, for the sake of this
all
thing
that
which,
work.
Yeah, all these people's labour. Yeah.
That's the thing. It's hundreds of people's labour goes mm. into these things. And whatever's gone on with Bryan Singer, if he's had stuff happening in the past while, this is a film that people need to see, because this is about mm. Freddie, it's about Queen. And to be a bit trite, the band say in the film, it belongs to all of us. It's mm. one of those, it's a story that belongs to all of us. And Freddie is still so very loved. That crowd mm. that we were in alone tells you that, because it was mainly, I think, an older crowd, and I would strongly suspect a lot of those people were fans in the day. You know, they yeah. were young people in the day who adored the band and probably saw them live and everything. Like the woman we spoke to that was sitting beside you, she was nearly in tears. We had a yeah. tiny chat with her at the end, and she just loved it so much. I mean, I think if they put it on straight away again, she would have sat there again through the whole thing.
Yeah. I have to have a quick look on Box Office Mojo to see how well this is doing in the States. date, because the relationship between the US fans and Queen and the UK fans and Queen, that was mentioned in the film. Queen broke the US quite early, but then, as the film points out, stopped touring in the US because of the video for I Want to Break Free with the cross-dressing.
They wouldn't show that. Yeah. They were too conservative. And it was fascinating, that scene where Freddie laments this, because he gets the blame of it.
Even though it wasn't his idea to
do it. Yeah, because it was Roger, wasn't it? I'm pretty sure it was... He wrote the song, and it was his idea to have them all cross-dress, you know, and play women. But it all gets in the press. It all gets blamed, in scare quotes, on Freddie.
In the States, it's only been out for 3 days, but it's done pretty amazingly at an estimated $50 million for these first 3 days. That's quite all right. $50 million for a film with a budget of $52 million on its opening weekend.
Yeah.
It's been awesomely advertised. This film has every reason to do amazingly in the UK and the US.
Well, judging by today, I would say it'll do well.
Yeah.
Because it's quite unusual for the Tyneside to be that packed on a Sunday afternoon.
When did it come out in the UK? Is it only...
I think just a few days ago, maybe.
Okay. So does this count as its opening weekend here as
It's possible. You need to check.
Oh, yeah. I do have the Wikipedia page for it open here. Some critics have been
a bit sniffy, have they? I think there were bits where the editing and things might have been a bit ropey, and there are bits where the CGI helping the cinematography was a bit obvious for me, especially like the going through the bus that soars into the tour bus when they're in the US, and that window transition in the front windscreen. I thought, you know, that would have looked good maybe 15 years ago. It looks now like it's 15 years old, that transition. It could have been a lot smoother. But then maybe so much of their budget went on reconstructing Wembley as it was in 85.
They reconstructed the Live Aid set. So I think what they just did is they reconstructed the front bit and that the rest was computer generated. So
yeah, but that would have been a lot of the CGI budget, would it not?
Yeah.
Something that big and that many people, that much detail.
So just to do a bit of date work, its opening weekend was last weekend. This is its second weekend in the UK. Yeah, it's doing astonishingly.
I would say this has been really long anticipated. I was saying earlier, it's somebody who I've lost touch with now, but I was very good friends with when I worked in Tesco years ago. She was just the hugest Queen and Freddie Mercury fan in the whole world. Just adored Freddie, and would follow some of the tribute bands and would always go to them. I'm trying to remember the tribute act that she used to go and see.
The tribute act I was trying to remember the name of is Flash Harry, and they're based in Northern Ireland.
I know that people like her would be the first in line for this film and probably see it multiple times. I would say this is one that will get a lot of repeat custom.
There's a whole podcast episode on its own though, isn't there? What films have you seen more than once at the cinema?
Ghostbusters 2016.
How many times?
Twice. And Let the Right One In 3 times in the cinema.
Right. Because I've never seen a film more than once in the cinema. It just feels, even when they're amazing, I just about have the patience to wait until it comes out on DVD.
I think the second Austin Powers film as well. I think I saw that twice too.
Austin Powers colon.
Which one was that?
The Spy Who Shagged Me.
Was that the first one? Or was that, maybe it was The Spy Who Shagged Me? Which gives us another Mike Myers link. It was the one with Heather Graham.
First one was called Austin Powers colon International Man of Mystery.
Yeah.
1997.
So it was The Spy Who Shagged
Me. Second one was The Spy Who Shagged Me, and the third one was Austin Powers in
Gold Member. Yeah. The other two I saw once in the cinema. I think I saw the second one twice in the cinema. There's probably others I've seen more than once. I've seen Dawn of the Dead in site-specific screenings with the Belfast Film Festival twice. Once was a Halloween screening in Castle Court Shopping Centre. So you're in a shopping mall,
of course,
watching Dawn of the Dead in a shopping mall. And it was a midnight screening. It was so fun. This is 200 people, most of us made up as zombies.
Very good.
And the other time was Goblin did a live soundtrack with it in Waterfront Hall. It was amazing.
Right. Well, there's a Queen connection here, because not only is this a band who did two soundtrack albums for films, this is a band whose music, was it just the music of Freddie Mercury that was used as part of Giorgio Moroder's soundtrack for Metropolis?
Oh, and, right, I don't know, actually.
And Queen themselves are actually quite
like big fans of early cinema, and so quite a lot of the music videos include little snippets of references to early films, and the music video for Radio Gaga is mostly made up of bits
from Metropolis.
This is a group who, when they had the opportunity, they liked to orchestrate some sort of visual track to go with along with the music, but a tenuous link.
I think even movie soundtracks, because this is something you're very interested in this, and I think I'm becoming a bit more aware of it and more interested. But certainly movie soundtracks done by pop bands or contemporary bands, you know, so not classical, and rock operas and that kind of thing. But also there's the phenomenon of the West End shows and stuff, because you've seen We Will Rock You.
Yeah. Again, it's something that we'll reward a bit looking into, because the norm with bands doing movie soundtracks seems to be that rather than it being that the band comes in and watches an unaccompanied version of the film and then starts composing the music, it's that early on in the writing of the film, the band gets a concept or two, comes up with a song, and then if a track gets released well before the films come out. Then there'll be a soundtrack album later down the line which will include one of those tracks and a bunch of other ones as well. So it's this often quite messy, choppy process. So that it's not quite the same as you get a composer in and you go, okay, soundtrack this, go. Put music on this film. And it's in part because if you're going to use the name of the band in marketing, the best thing to do is to have something by that band specifically to do with that film ready to release well before the film's
radio
come out.
Radio play and that sort of thing that helps in marketing.
Use that radio play to pre-sell the film.
But also now it's become so common to use already existing music as soundtrack music. So not just temp tracks anymore, but to build whole films. So the likes of Mamma Mia and Sunshine on the East, where you're using the music of a specific band to build a whole narrative around. Isn't the stage play We Were Rocky, isn't it a bit like that?
Yes.
It's not exclusively Queen, but it's that rock opera thing, is it?
Well, yeah, it's, we're going to take a bunch of Queen songs and we're going to have characters in a narrative where every now and then one of them has to stop and sing a song about their situation, which also happens to be a Queen song. I'm just trying to work out. There was a bit where I thought, this music is from the future of the time when things are happening in the story space, because it was when Freddie had got his house and he was having one of his first big lavish parties, and the music, I thought, this didn't come out until about five or six years later.
Yeah. It was... Can't touch this, but it was what that was sampled from, wasn't it? It wasn't MC Hammer, it was he'd sampled that.
No, I think you've got MC Hammer mixed up with Vanilla Ice. MC Hammer, born Stanley Kirk Burrell. Let's work out the timings on this. It's Hammer time. Okay, Can't Touch This, or You Can't Touch This, 1990. So yeah, we were getting a piece of...
Where does Vanilla Ice come in?
Okay, Vanilla Ice used the bass line from Under Pressure, completely with permission, as part of his mid-1990s
song. Yeah, I know that, but I was talking about
Ice Baby.
That one, wasn't I?
Can't Touch This.
Was that in it, or am I...
It seemed to be, initially, it was music somebody was playing at Freddie's party that was supposed to be happening in something like 1979, but you know, this is music from 1990. But then of course I realised no one's hearing this music at this party, this is just incidental non-diegetic music. But I also thought, isn't it a bit weird that they're using popular music from the future of the story space as non-diegetic music?
But was it not sampled from a disco track?
I don't think so. Okay, I have to look this up. Okay, all right. The song samples the prominent opening riff of the Rick James song Super Freak.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Oh,
that's
my.
What I was trying to tell you.
Did I just do something? I just did a thing. Okay, fine. Super Freak, 1981.
That's what I was trying to tell you.
Okay, right. So we can... All right, then we'll go back and have this conversation again.
So, no, we're not. I'm keeping this in. Because I read the credits.
Okay, Super Freak. I've mixed up Super Freak with You Can't Touch This. Okay, sorry. So 1981 might still have been in the future of when that was supposed to be happening.
Maybe, but was that not the early 80s? Because it's not long after that that it all goes apart and he goes to Munich, and that was 1984, that stuff.
If you look at the discography, Day at the Races was 1976, News of the World 1977, Jazz 1978, The Game 1980, Flash Gordon 1980, and then Hot Space, which is the poppy one, 1982. Okay, yeah, it roughly fits with that. This is a highly compressed.
Yeah, it is a very.
Okay, well, on that utterly mortifying confusion of two pieces of music and that rendition of Bohemian Rhapsody from Stone Cold Classics, the compilation album.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. Is that the very first Queen album I owned was Greatest Hits 1. Hardly a diehard fan.
I want to know how it is that people get cast as real-life figures and also have an acting career. I've just checked the bios of each of the people who played the members of Queen. Every one of them has an acting career, quite an illustrious one in several places, because Rami Malek is an Egyptian prince in the Night at the Museum films.
Oh, right.
Very posh, well-spoken Egyptian prince. So all four of them have some career and have been picked as these people who they look exactly like. It seems like astonishing luck or just great hair, makeup and prosthetics.
Well, I would say so, yeah.
Just widen somebody's nose a bit.
The picture of, was it Gwilym?
Yeah.
Lee? Yeah, he looked very different. But the big Brian May hair.
You could probably put Brian May hair on me and make me look like Brian. There was a dramatisation a few years back of the early career of the Pythons, up to that point when they had that TV interview about the life of Brian.
Okay.
Where Malcolm Muggeridge was a dick to them. The six guys who they got to play the Pythons were total spitting images of the Pythons when they were young. I suppose it's just a matter of you get people who really want to play the part and then they can alter their face shape just a little bit, make up the prosthetics and the hair. Yeah, I suppose it's all doable.
Coming up to the Wayne's World bit.
I remember once seeing Wayne's World and feeling a little bit betrayed because I thought, is Queen a headbanging kind of group? Well, yeah, okay, so there's one of their tracks has about a 2 minute bit in it which is headbangy, but is anything else that they do headbangy? I felt slightly betrayed. Like Queen had been taken out of the niche that they had formed for themselves and claimed as a hair band, which they never were.
No.
They never were Guns N' Roses.
No. This is still operatic. It is mixing them. But yeah, and again, Wayne's World, that was an early beginning of my awareness of Queen. And then also that scene is parodied in a spoof film called Loaded Weapon. It was a spoof of Lethal. Do you remember that with Emilio Estevez?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, and they parody that scene from Wayne's World as well from, in the car.
It's from the makers of the Naked Gun, isn't it?
Yeah.
That little franchise.
Yeah.
I can picture the diagram right now of the intertextual relationships here.
There's a lot going on, yeah. There's a lot of things that are linking up, because even talking about zombie movies earlier, I was talking about Shaun of the Dead and Dawn of the Dead in terms of very tenuous Queen links.
So what do you think, for the benefit of anyone who might actually decide whether to go and see this film or not, depending upon what we say?
I don't think that's a thing that happens. Anybody who gets in touch with me tells me I haven't seen the films that you're talking about, so I'll listen to the episode when I've seen the film, because we are pretty spoilery. Maybe it's different with the likes of a biopic, but then if you don't know the life story of someone, then it is going to be spoilery. It's such an enjoyable film. It's really rousing. It's everything you want, like, and it's all the songs probably that you can think of are going to be in there.
There are candy flossy elements of it,
yeah,
but none of it is okay, now here's another song that you like that you really want us to play for you. Everything is motivated.
Yeah, it's really well placed.
It's a finely made piece of cinema. Okay, perhaps we're getting an account of reality which is less interesting than an actual truthful one would have been in places, but there is this big pressure on all the surviving members of Queen in the making of any film like this, which is that this is as critical as of Freddie's memory as they were going to let any film be.
It does say that he's not perfect. He wasn't the easiest person to get on with a lot of the time, but look how special a thing he gave the world. Somebody like him was alive at a time when we could record him amply and save that voice. That's a voice that's going to last for as long as humanity can.
As long as we're constantly copying the recordings from one medium to the next.
Yeah, it's going to
as each goes obsolete.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's going to last. But that's the beauty of it as well, and to capture that idea of them recording on tape and the layering on the tape and the tapes wearing out and them referring to all of that, and that we're not doing that anymore, because it gives it a texture and a sound, and then that texture being on the vinyl as well when that was coming out, that's so much a part of the music from then. I think that's one of the reasons why me being an old person now, me being a 20th century person, is that I think I get really bored with a lot of contemporary music now because it's too clean. I like the scratchiness. I like that I can hear the older media being used in the 20th century.
And this film is excited about the technologies involved.
Yeah.
There's lots of people throwing vinyl at each other.
Yeah.
Lots of these things are physical objects that you can throw around a room, and there's lots of frisbeeing them around.
Yeah, it's not carrying around a MacBook, selecting a few files.
And when they're recording them, we're seeing a lot of tapes on reels, going back and forth and back and forth, lots of pushing
it's
buttons.
It's the clicking, it's the rewinding, it's the having to wait, it's the pushing up of things, it's the putting kettles on microphones, throwing coins on the drums, throwing beer on the drums.
That was the thing, there's so many shots of Roger Taylor smacking drums and all this water coming up from the drums. Well, the film implies that it was all actually beer that he used to deaden the sound a little bit.
That gives you that visual spray as well that's catching the light, so there's something visually exciting. It's almost explosive, it's like fireworks, it's just another little bit of glitz going on.
It was definitely part of the Queen look.
Sweat.
I thought it was sweaty drums. Obviously it was contrived.
This will probably be out well after it's not in cinemas anymore. If you haven't seen it and the run is over in the cinema, I really recommend checking it out. Even if you're not a Queen fan, you probably would be by the end of the film.
The glasses are not entirely rose-tinted.
No, they're not.
It's a fun ride.
No. I think the best biopics are like that, where they show the bad with the good. Yeah. And for the fashions alone, for the costumes alone, you need to see it.
Thank you for tuning in to this Cozy Pea Pod production. If you got something out of this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good rating wherever you're accessing it and share it with someone you know will find it really interesting. If early releases and bonus content sound appealing, visit patreon.com/avcultures and join one of our support tiers. If you want to help the show but can't manage a membership, we'd love you to join the conversation with AV Cultures Pod on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter. The music is Common Ground by Airtone, used under a 3.0 Creative Commons non-commercial license and is available at ccmixer.org. I've been Paula Blair, and you've been a fantastic audience. Mind yourselves, until next time.